Elizabeth Baird is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you?
I am a hopeless romantic.
Same.
I love love.
Yeah.
I find not a lot of other reasons to get out of bed in the morning, but the potential for feeling that love.
Well, that's really sweet.
And so I think I'm doing well.
Great. You know, I'm the same way. Just feel like it gets a little harder the older and older we get.
I know. Well, and it's easy to get jaded. And I think that's what's the most difficult part about staying committed to the idea of love or to the nurturing of love. And I'm talking about romantic love, passionate love, intimate love, not kind of the love we have for our coffee in the morning, right? Or for a good nighty or an evening on the town. But that love that comes in the form of our breath. Right? That thing that drives our motivations to succeed and to be better people are all surrounded by this hope that we will access and maintain and experience love. And because Friday's Valentine's Day, it just seems like the appropriate time to have a conversation about love. And every year I try to come at it from a different direction because people have so many different feelings about Valentine's Day, cynical or completely into it or dismissive or don't even know that it's Friday. But this year, at this moment in time, I have many people that I care deeply, deeply about who are in the stages of grieving a lost love. They're in the process of losing that love, or they have lost that love of their life. And that heaviness is with me this year, that heart hurt for them and the unimaginable experience of having to let go of someone that you've devoted your life to or been attached to or dependent upon, and to have that relationship end is enough to make even the strongest of us wonder, do I even bother with this? I remember when my father-in-law passed away. It was about 23 years ago now. And the day of the funeral, my mother-in-law, just as a matter of conversation, turned and said, I will never go through this again.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was it for her. She just kind of shut that door of those relationships. I think the pain was so profound and so overwhelming that she just was done and made the conscious effort to kind of shut that door to that possibility, that kind of intimate, passionate, or companionate, or whatever that long-term connected relationship looked like. And so I'm thinking a lot about that today and that choice that we make. You know, a lot of people would argue that we don't have a choice when it comes to falling in love, that we're overcome with the chemicals that rush through us. And, you know, it just hits us like a train, and all the poetry and great songs of love and loss that have been written about that just, you know, rush of intensity that falling in love has. But aside from that, there is a choice as to whether or not we remain in that place of love. Because that initial rush of intensely falling in love, those chemicals of testosterone and the butterflies in your stomach and, you know, that overwhelm in your life.
That oxytocin.
The oxytocin, yeah. That's released, yeah, during sex and, you know, all of the pieces of that chemical wild ride, it does start to change. And that's another part of the story, because a lot of people assume that that passion, that lust we felt at the beginning, dies out at some time, and then you're just kind of in that comfortable old shoe of a relationship that never really has it. That's not really factual. That's not true. Research doesn't support that. It does wane and change in certain ways, but that passion and lust can really retain itself through the entirity of a marriage. And again, it's a choice. It's a choice to put the effort into and the attitude into retaining that in your relationship. But back to this decision to move from that kind of place of lust and attraction to attachment, which is that third phase of love. There's three phases we go through until we get to that long-term committed relationship. Lust is the driver, the reason we even decide to fall in love. The second one is attraction. It's why we stay with that person. We start to find more and more things that we have in common and that we appreciate about the other. And so that attraction kind of drives the relationship. But around 36 months, it starts to shift. The tenor of the relationship shifts. And you either kind of move into this phase of attachment where your whole sense of homeostasis and balance becomes connected to that other person. You know, they become that integral part of your day-to-day. Or the relationship kind of dies out and, you know, you go on to the next relationship.
Which I'm very familiar with.
Yes, I think a lot of people.
That explains my 36-month trend. There we go.
A lot of people are serial 36-monthers, mm-hmm. monthers, that they get to about month 30 and they think, oh, I don't love this person anymore. I don't feel those feelings. It must be that this relationship's over and they move on. But to move into that attachment phase is a whole nother level, that whole deep space, that physical attachment we have to the other person. And that becomes a decision, a choice to stay in that or to allow ourselves to go there or to make that commitment to it. And then, or there's a choice to move on. And I was also thinking today, because you know how weird things just pop up. And someone left me the poem, The Prophet by Cahil Gibran. And I hadn't thought about that for years, but when my husband and I got married, the priest that married us read that poem. And if I were to be really honest, at 24, I had no idea what he was reading to us. And one, because I was so nervous getting married, but two, it just seemed the words were just so ethereal. But I read it again yesterday and it hit me in a whole different place. And I'm not going to read the whole poem, but those of you who are familiar with this kind of 70s ideal of the dance of autonomy and intimacy that happens in true long-term love is a interesting visit into what that commitment looks like. But what I took away from reading that again is that there is no pure love that we can experience unless we are also simultaneously signing up for inevitable deep pain and heartache, that the two dance together, that to have the courage to fully open yourself to love and to commitment to another person, you also are opening yourself up in vulnerability to being hurt or disappointed or grieving the loss of that love. Because, and I don't want this to be a whole dark hour, but our whole path in life ends up with death at some point. And so if whether we are the first ones to leave or our partner is at some point that we will be grieving that loss whenever that comes. So I thought today we would talk about whether or not love is worth it. On the eve of Valentine's Day, I want to throw it out there. Why are we so compelled to love? Why do we love? And there's a lot of research, surprisingly, supporting this whole idea of why we love. There's some science behind it. There's some unsexy reasons why we fall in love. And there's some really interesting, mysterious reasons why we fall in love. And so I thought we would sort through them. And then I would also open up the phone lines because I'm curious to know if people have allowed themselves to dive in deeply to love, or if they find themselves always holding back a bit or trying to protect their heart. And the other thing is, do you have a love story? Because John Gottman, who we'll talk about a little later, he and his wife are experts on marriage and relationships. Their expertise is in the predictability of whether or not a relationship or a marriage will last or whether it will end up in divorce. But the thing that they have found, one of the tests of whether or not a relationship will survive is the love story of the couple, how they talk about their origin story. So if a couple comes in for counseling and we say, you know, how did you meet each other? And if the couple starts off with, oh, it was love at first sight, or I knew there was something special, or, you know, there was a twinkle in their eye, that Gottman will say that's a nugget that says that we have some place we can go with this relationship. But if the couple comes in, you say, what's your love story? How'd you meet? It's like, well, you know, I didn't like him the first time I saw him, or it was one of the worst days of my life, or I felt awful. That is an indication of where that relationship's going. So to take a moment and think, how would you tell someone someone when they say, how did you meet your partner? How would you start that story? So that's today. Why do we love? I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. If you'd like to learn more about the show, you can find us on Facebook, The Reluctant Therapist. Follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. This week, my daughter threw up a photo of my husband and I on a trip up in South Dakota, if you want to check that out. You can always send me an email to Elizabeth@TheReluctantTherapist.com. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org. All 10 years of our shows are there. Or you can podcast our show by visiting Apple Podcasts or NPR Podcasts. Search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, and the show will be uploaded to your device, and you can listen at your convenience. So I look forward to seeing where our conversation takes us today. We'll be back in a moment to take your calls.
For all those times you stood by me, for all the truth that you made me see, for all the joy you brought to my life, for all the wrong that you made right, for every dream you made come true, for all
I don't know, Tyler, that probably wasn't the right song to start with, because now I'm choked up and I don't know if I can start talking.
You got me singing back here in the production studio. So.
I know, a little Celine Dion. Oh, heart-wrenching. This is The Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And today, I want to talk about love and why do we love. And I want to start off the lecture in me wants to start off talking about the unsexy reasons why we fall in love. And one of them is evolution, pure evolution. And the science behind this is that as we have evolved as humans and moved through our evolutionary process, at some point, as we became upright and started walking on two legs, the size of the babies that were born, the offspring, had to change, because otherwise the woman couldn't give birth. The heads would not pass through the birth canal. So evolutionarily, human babies are born not as developed as other species, like a deer, right? When a baby deer is born, they are almost up on those two legs and bounding away within a few hours after being born. And a lot of other species are born with their brain functioning fully intact. They know how to be that animal without a lot of nurturing necessary. They know how to get up on four legs. They know how to feed themselves. They know how to, you know, navigate their areas. But human babies don't have that capacity, clearly. Our babies are born needing a lot of care. And also the brain development is not fully finished when babies are born. They still have a lot of brain development that has to happen. So the evolutionary theory is that love exists because to raise a human baby, it takes two parents, because it's a lot of physical effort to raise that baby, to make sure they have food and you have safety and you have your, you know, habitat that you're in. And so because it's such a complex experience, that there requires this pair bonding, that it takes the two individuals to raise that baby. And so the idea is that the brain is wired to create this pair bond, And love is that commitment device that creates that pair bonding, that vasopressin that we release, and the oxytocin that is released. Men release vasopressin, women release oxytocin. Those two hormones are released, and they bond us to each other. And then also that brain wiring that says the two of us are bonded together, it takes a huge parental investment to raise that child. So that's the evolutionary idea behind it, that literally falling in love is just a commitment device to help us raise our offspring. And that brings up an interesting side piece to the story, is the clitoris on a woman has only one purpose. There's no biological purpose other than pleasure. That's why it exists. And so evolutionary theory is that the reason that it's there to have pleasure is, one, to motivate people to reproduce, right, to procreate, but also that when someone can bring their partner to climax, that is an indication that that partner is tender and would be careful and would be a good partner for raising offspring together.
You've got me giggling like I'm in middle school again over here with this conversation.
I know. But it's science. I mean, I think it's important to understand that there are some early ideas of how we got to this place of forming love partnerships or pair bonding. And so I love that theory, too, about the different sexual organs and how they operate and why it's important to become a tender lover and caregiver, because it says, I have patience and I will take the time to care not just for you, but for our offspring. So that theory then falls a little short at some point, because then the idea would be, well, as soon as the children, right, as soon as the offspring are off and on their own, then that pair bond would end and there'd be no reason for it. And so then couples would just disperse. But that's just one part of it. There's another really non-sexy reason, theory of why we fall in love or why we make these pair bonds. And are you familiar with the idea of the gut biome, or the microbiomes of the gut, and that there's a lot of research connecting how healthy our gut biome is and our moods and our attitudes, depression, anxiety. So one of the theories
I drink is a lot of kombucha. So I
to keep that
yeah, there
too.
You go.
Well, you'll be happy that you do, because one of the theories also is that we really aren't the driving force in love and passion. It's our gut biomes, our microbes in our gut, that are the driving force in our attraction and our desire to mate. And that in some almost Twilight Zone way, we're just hosts for our microbes that are looking for other microbes that they can combine with and make more microbes. And so part of the reason that we become attractive, our cheeks flush, our lips flush, we have that clear skin and bright eyes that attract other people to us, our microbes, our gut biome determines, you know, gives us that flush. That when it's a healthy biome, it sends out those messages of the clear eyes and healthy hair and healthy skin. And so that is an attraction to other microbes that go, oh, wait, there's nice microbes trying to let me know to come over here. And so then those microbes find each other and create that mating process.
Well, you just made falling in love so much less sexy.
I know. I said I was going to start with the non-sexy reasons why. But it's fascinating if you think about it, especially if you're a Twilight Zone person, to think that it really has nothing to do with us and that we're being driven to this attraction and love. All right. So those are the unsexy reasons. But let's talk about then the other kind of more mystical and emotional bonds that we create with others and why they last. And what's interesting about that is that we didn't even really have a lot of studies done on love or falling in love or defining passionate love or romantic love or, you know, what drives us until the 1970s, until like the mid-1970s. Even though the Masters and Johnson, you know, research had been taking place since the late 50s, the actual research on love and what that looks like was blocked by the Senate, whoever was, you know, appropriating funds and grants to study love. And one of the senators at the time in the early 70s said, why do we have to know about everything? Why can't some things just be a mystery? I don't want to know all the reasons why I've fallen in love with my wife or not. I just want to enjoy the process. And so there was a lot of pushback against doing the studying. But since then, there has been a lot of research done. And some of the most prominent researchers are Dr. Helen Fisher and Dr. Elena Hatfield, who did a lot of research around the phases of love and the things that drive our love. And if you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And in honor of Valentine's Day, I wanted to talk about love and what motivates us to love or to fall in love or to create long-term committed relationships, even in the face of the potential heartache that comes with being in love. And you are invited to participate in the conversation if you have any thoughts or comments. Our number is 805-781-3875. All right, so Helen Fisher points to three different reasons why we fall in love. And the first one is the chemical reasons. And you mentioned that at the start of the show, Tyler, that we're driven by these chemicals inside of us, these hormones that get released that kind of motivate us. So when we meet someone that we're attracted to, and that first, you know, our attraction to another person is set in the first 90 seconds to 4 minutes of meeting them. And so we generally know whether or not we're going to have any sort of long-term attraction to someone in that 90 seconds to 4 minutes. And once we meet someone, we release this testosterone. We also release those fight or flight hormones that cause us to get dry mouth or our hands get sweaty or we don't know if we should run or if we should just jump on the person and kiss them. It's that rush of intensity. And also we release dopamine. And dopamine makes you feel happy. It controls your attention. It controls your moods and your motivation to do anything. Dopamine is also very addictive. It feels good once we start getting in the dopamine high. And then we start craving those feelings of dopamine, which means we start craving being around the person that motivated those happy feelings. Dopamine in high levels kind of mimics what it's like to be on cocaine. So it really kind of takes us into this high mental state. And then there's norepinephrine, which makes you feel thrilled and excited and constantly on. You have butterflies. It's those sleepless nights where you're thinking, incessantly about this person and wanting to talk to them and be close to them. And then we also have serotonin, which also causes this restless kind of energy. It keeps our focus on our beloved at all times. We can't stop thinking about them. We become obsessive. It mimics a lot of OCD behaviors when you are in a serotonin state. And unlike dopamine and norepinephrine, which go up when we are falling in love, serotonin levels actually drop when we're falling in love. And then the other chemicals that really impact the connection, the love connection, are the vasopressin and oxytocin that I talked about. And both of them are bonding hormones that are released during orgasm. And oxytocin is also released when a woman gives birth as the baby leaves the birth canal. She's flooded with oxytocin, which is also the bonding hormone. And so we may think that we're just madly in love, or that there's, you know, we feel like we might be going through an intoxicated state. But the fact of the matter is, you are. We become insanely in love, and it becomes almost out of our control to be able to manage those feelings when we are in the throes of falling in love. Besides the chemical pieces, what triggers the hormones to make us fall in love is this sense of mystery, that we as humans are driven towards wanting to maximize the varieties that we experience in life. That's why eating different foods can be really exciting and, you know, awakening our palate and our hunger drives can keep us feeling excited about life. But also when we find someone we're interested in, experiencing new adventures with this person, new experiences, new conversations, releases dopamine. And so that mystery of that relationship drives us towards love. Also, we're driven by our differences. We are driven by this unknown or unseen genetic differences. We can't see the genetic differences in the makeup of people we're attracted to or their different DNA. But our microbes or our unconscious drives know when we're with someone who has a different DNA. And the whole idea biologically is we want to be with someone, we want to procreate with someone whose DNA is different enough or complementary enough so that our offspring are healthier and have more immunity. So we're attracted to the differences. And you know, there's a lot of research on scents and smells, and that our olfactory senses are our biggest drivers in choosing and finding our mates. We smell our best genetic matches. And there's some fascinating research done at the University of Texas where they had men wear t-shirts for 5 days, and then they get not use any scents or colognes or anything, just wear them each day. And then women were given these t-shirts to smell, and the women were able to smell the scent of their best genetic matches.
How interesting.
Wild, right?
Yeah.
Which is just a whole other side note, why we shouldn't wear anything with a scent. We should try to get rid of all scented fabric softeners, you know, deodorants, hair conditioners, perfumes, because they all block. They all have artificial pheromones and chemicals in them, but they block our capacity to really smell our best mate.
How interesting. But what about for people that, you know, enjoy something that gives them a smell that reminds them of something? Like I wear an essential oil that reminds me, makes me think of back in Louisiana.
Yeah, well, and again, there's nothing inherently wrong about that. And if it's a natural scent, it doesn't have any chemicals, because it's really the unhealthy part is the chemicals that are put in different products to mimic pheromones, because most of them have huge amounts of carcinogenic substances. But an essential oil or natural smells kind of give that nice memory sense back. But if you use it too much, then it does kind of block that musky smell. It feels so 1970s, but that musky smell that is one of our attraction markers.
Interesting. You know why we did have a caller call in who could not stay on the line. Okay. And Dan called in and recommended a couple of documentaries.
Dan.
And he just recommended a documentary that Maggie Gyllenhaal hosted back in 2011 called Why Is Sex Fun, that gets into more of the scientific things that you were explaining. So if anyone wanted to continue this, go on the internet. I just looked it up and it's easily accessible. And we did have a couple of other callers call in, but they seem to have dropped off. So might want to give them that number one more time.
All right, call back. Well, and it might be a fun documentary to watch on Valentine's Day for the science nerds who are looking for a fun way to connect. Yeah, our number is 805-781-3875. Love for you to be part of the conversation. Clearly, I have a lot to say about it, but I'd love to hear your take on this. And what are your feelings about love and relationships and why we bother to put our heart on the line when we know ultimately it's going to end up or experience some huge heartache? 805-781-3875. The other piece of Dr. Fisher's research is what attracts us is symmetry. We look towards those that we find beautiful, whatever their symmetry is, that aligns with our symmetry and our way our face is shaped and our eyes are shaped, and that attracts us. They're also, we are attracted to the sense of homogamy, which means we are attracted to those who are like us, who have similar values and similar views on the world, similar things that we hate. My husband always laughed that that's one of our bonding issues, is that we tend to hate the same things and we don't have to talk about it. We just look at each other and we know that we're over it. And then the third thing Dr. Fisher says is inherent in love attachments is our individual love map, and that all of us have this unique set of criteria that only we understand or are motivated by, the set of characteristics that are both physical and non-physical that drive our attraction to other people. And one of the exercises that she recommends is to sit down and really think about what are those characteristics, both physical and non-physical, that you feel attracted to in others, whether it's their personality or something physical about how they look or the work that they do or the interests that they have. Because Dr. Fisher's real push for her research on love and why we love and the book she's written is her feeling that for something so essential to the well-being of humans, we don't teach anyone how to access love. We don't teach anyone at any point in their lives how to respond in intimate relationships or how to know if we're attracted to the right person. And so she feels strongly that these skills or this knowledge of what love looks like and what long-term committed relationships look like and why we feel attracted be things that we teach, just like math and reading and science. Because if we spend our life grappling with and bemoaning the love that we have or the love that we don't have, wouldn't it be most important that we learn to master those experiences? So that's one of the reasons why Valentine's Day is such a great opportunity to take seriously kind of that piece of our lives. To look in at ourselves and explore what is it that keeps me in my relationship or what is it that prevents me from going into relationships at all? What is the experiences that I've had in my life that prevent me from transitioning my relationships from that kind of attraction phase where it's fun to be with someone and dating is fun and we find a lot in common? What blocks us from then moving into that attachment phase where we really start to build our reality, our life, our daily experience around the other person? One of the things that prevents us from really being able to easily jump into those relationships is timing. That most people really get that one of the reasons people really get hung up is that they have poor timing. You know, you meet someone who's in a relationship with someone else, or you meet someone and you're in a relationship, or you meet someone and you don't have the time because you're pursuing a career. There's always that timing piece that prevents relationships from connecting. And then the other piece, another unsexy science piece, is that early attachment experiences when we're babies, when we're children, impact our ability to either attach with someone else, to make that relationship or not. And so those that have a good, solid, early, secure attachment with their caregivers tend to have a more successful time creating long-term committed relationships with others. And those who had an insecure or anxious attachment with caregivers, either their caregivers were negligent or not available or weren't in their lives, it becomes more challenging for them to then make long-term committed relationships. So that's Fisher's take on why we fall in love. A lot of people say that we fall in love just because it feels good and we wouldn't want life any other way. So what's your take on it? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. Katie, you're on the air. Hi. Are you there?
Hi. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. I really enjoy your show.
Thanks for calling in.
So I'm just responding to a comment that you made a while ago about love, the connection between love, falling in love, and creating a bond so that you can make a baby. Mm. And so my concern about that is that it seems like a very heteronormative approach, mm-hmm. and therefore anything that does not fit within that is then othered. So I feel like, so my concern is that would be just exclusive regarding, you know, just falling in love with somebody from, you know, the opposite sex in order to make a baby together. It seems very kind of limited because of that. What do you think about that?
Well, I understand that from the social standpoint, but what the research I was talking about before was kind of an evolutionary biological aspect, kind of a non-emotional, but just more of a science-based why we think that people even started to make pair bonds, and it was around that. So that research really isn't a social commentary about why, you know, we choose to be in relationships that are more emotion-based or, you know, heart-centered or those around attachment. Those would be separate than kind of that just physical drive. And it, again, it's just one biological theory along with the microbiomes piece.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Because it's an interesting dilemma that comes up in class a lot. It's like, well, for same-sex couples, and what is the drive towards making pair bonds or long-term commitments? And I would think it would be much more what Helen Fisher discovered, that the pair bond theory is really limited because it only says relationships happen around the child rearing. And then why would couples stay together once a child is gone? And there was so much evidence of pairs staying committed and together for long-term periods of time. So that's why she brought in the whole socio-emotional piece of it, that there had to be something beyond just the procreation piece that creates a loving long-term attachment.
Yeah.
Which makes more sense to me, because the other one does feel really limiting. But it's an interesting scientific idea.
Yeah. I just think that also, I mean, we have to remember that scientific, you know, science has framework and has windows too. So we have to kind of challenge those sometimes, you know, I think.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I don't think that, like, that a heteronormative kind of, like, approach is, in terms of, in relationship to evolution, I don't think it's, like, a recent phenomenon or something like that. You know what I mean? Or a less recent phenomenon. So anyways, but thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you called in, Katie. Have a happy Valentine's Day. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to continue taking your calls.
The sky was dark this morning. When I raised my head, I stood at the window. Darkness was my bane. But suddenly a sunbeam thrilled me to my weary heart. It was the prettiest thing I'd ever seen. I knew I had to keep my love, keep my love alive. Keep my love, keep my love alive. Since I was a baby girl, wanted one thing most in this world, it was to keep my love alive. Yeah, I gotta keep my love alive.
Barrett? Our number is 805-781-3875, and I pose today, why is it that we bother to fall in love? Why do we bother to fall in love when there's the potential for such heartache at the other end of that relationship or throughout that relationship, that we can't really experience real, pure, romantic, connected, attached love unless we're willing to feel the other side of that, which is pain and agony and despair when that love is not reciprocated or it's lost or it changes or it ends. And yet we do it over and over and over again for millennia upon millennia, that we create these pair bonds, these attachments for reasons far beyond just the evolutionary biological reason. We are brought together for so many reasons. So what are yours? 805-781-3875. Hi, Dominic?
Yes.
How are you? You're on the air today.
I'm fine. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two questions. The one is, I grew up in a very old-fashioned Italian family, and my mother had 11 siblings, 9 were girls, and my grandfather basically arranged all those marriages. Hmm. I was wondering if you're in an arranged marriage where you don't, in some cultures, meet the person to the day of the wedding, do you skip the chemical reaction you get from lust and go right into a bonding thing? And the other question is, also growing up, I heard a lot of people saying about other people, oh, he's just in love with love, or she's just in love with love. Can you become addicted to the chemical reactions that you get when you have love?
Those are great questions. I'm going to jump into the first one. So the process of finding love doesn't require that we go through the lust and attraction to attachment. That, as I said earlier, the lust and attraction can all kind of exist at the same time as that attachment piece. That ideally, really, we are nurturing those feelings of attraction as they develop, you know, as those chemicals kind of emerge. Because not everything is love at first sight. Sometimes we grow in those feelings and that lust or those feelings of passion are ignited. And I really like, there was a a great quote about arranged marriages that said, you know, in Western culture, the relationships start on the top of the mountain at the peak of love, and then they have nowhere to go but kind of down the mountain. And so there's not a lot of potential for growth. But in an arranged marriage, you start together at the bottom of this mountain and you work your way up to the top together, which makes it much more deep and rich and whole.
So, that makes sense, because all nine of my aunt's marriages endured forever. None of them ever got divorced.
Yeah, that's a fascinating, and there's a lot of kind of talk in the world of marriage, the field of marriage, about the idea of arranged marriages or more family-motivated marriages, because we have such a poor track record in Western culture with keeping marriages together, that maybe this whole idea that we want to marry someone that we're physically attracted to primarily first is not the best way to approach a long-term pair bond. So that is something that is discussed in the profession. And then your other question about becoming addicted to the chemicals, I don't know if it's addicted to the chemicals, but addicted to the feeling, and our body becomes habituated to that experience of seeing our loved one or thinking of our loved one and having those hormones released. And I think the level of our attachment to someone is only recognized really when that relationship ends, and the body will go through an actual physical withdrawal when those hormones no longer are motivated or stimulated by our loved one. So there is definitely a physical component.
Got it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dominic. Have a wonderful day. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Whitney, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm calling. I keep trying to think of a way to word this without sounding like a weirdo, but...
These are my favorite people.
I became, hit puberty. I've always been attracted to men that are quite a bit older than me. My husband's like 20 years older than me. My father, my daughter, is a different guy, 15 years. And my dad left when I was like little, like 8. And is it because, is there like a glitch? Do I have a daddy complex or is there... Is there something, because I really am attracted to older men. I don't like guys my age.
Are you still married?
I am, yeah. My husband and I are married.
And are you enjoying that relationship?
Oh, yeah. I love him to death. We get along so well.
Then, Whitney, it's not a glitch. It's just the story of your life. And then you were able to take what that experience was in your childhood and utilize what your feelings were as you came out of that and found a great pair bond. You know, that's really the more important story, is what do we do with the things that we all get kind of broken by when we're young? Because everyone's childhood has some sort of glitch, as you said, or something that may not have fit the storybook progress. But the real key is, how did you learn to manage those level feelings of attraction that you developed growing up to whoever it was that you were attracted to or fell in love with? How did you feel about those feelings? Do you feel good about the attraction or the attachment you have? You know, or do you feel ashamed? It sounds like you feel good about it. And so long as you're moving towards that positive state of this fulfills me and it feels healthy and it feels good and it feels right, there's no glitch in that.
Thank you so much. That definitely made me feel validated. Thank you.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. The only time we get into trouble is when things don't feel right. But if you're on a path of love and connection, you're in a beautiful place, my friend. Enjoy.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Happy Valentine's Day. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. Margie, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I would like to hear your thinking about love and lust in older people, old people like myself.
Past menopause people.
And my situation, and I'd like your feedback on my situation, is that I am attracted to younger men, and younger men are attracted to me.
Way to go, Margie.
Well, okay, but it does present the dilemma of I'm definitely getting older. I mean, we all are, of course. Mm-hmm. But I'm in my 80s, and I have men in their 50s and 60s and even younger than that are attracted to me, and I'm attracted to them. And it's awkward. It's fun, but it's awkward because there really isn't any future. Mm-hmm. Do you hear what I'm sure you mean?
I think I understand, and I'm going to jump in just because of time.
Sure, please do.
Okay, two things, Margie. Do you watch the show Grace and Frankie?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you're living Grace's life, right? Because she married the guy that's like 25 years younger than her, and she's grappling with a lot of those same social issues of being an older woman and how an older woman is supposed to behave, and yet she has this great, healthy relationship. And I think the other piece of this, just to consider, is that you're not looking for a relationship to procreate and make children and do that anymore, right? You're done with that. You're creating a whole different social norm. And that's the beauty of the extended life cycle that we're experiencing. You know, the fastest growing population right now are those 85 and over. And it's a new frontier. And so you're getting to write. You're the first pioneers to write what sex and love and relationship look like in our elder years. And so there is no norm. You're the norm. And I want you to enjoy it and go back and watch another episode of Grace and Frankie and just love it.
Okay, Elizabeth, yes. I got to say this. I am Frankie. I am absolutely not Grace. I have none of the characteristics.
Doesn't matter.
Of Grace.
Doesn't matter.
Except that I am older than the men that I see and spend time with. But I'm a crazy Frankie person.
Well, I love that even more. But I think my takeaway is, Margie, the takeaway is there is no litmus test for what is okay and normal in old age anymore, because one, there's no one doing research on it. It's such a new field. And two, we don't really know how to define what that is. So I think that's the beauty in this, is that you should write it down and pass it on to your children and say, hey, here's what you have to look forward to coming up. Margie, have a happy Valentine's Day. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're talking about what it is that makes us love and why would we jump in there and even take a chance at something that has the potential for huge heartache. Ken, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a question about the research in this, the falling in love process.
Okay.
I'm wondering what, if there is research that determines what's the percentage of this that's biochemical and what's the percentage that's psychological, like our childhood experiences, the quality of relationship we see in our parents or in people around us, those kinds of things. Is there any kind of research that has broken that down?
Hi, Ken, thanks for that question. And I don't have research in front of me, so I don't know if I can tell you the statistical breakdown. But what I can tell you is that you hit the nose on the head, the nail on the head. Yeah, the nail on the head. That there is that biological drive, that lust, the attraction, the attachment, the phases we move through, the hormones, the chemicals that get released. And that is the driver. But our childhood experiences, our family of origin experiences around how we were taught to love, how we were loved, the modeling we saw in our parents or aunts and uncles or grandparents or whoever we were surrounded with, their love style and love relationship, all of those have a huge impact on whether or not we're able to or willing to execute a long-term committed relationship or to what level of depth we're willing to go. That you can be driven, we might all be driven towards this pair bond, but our ability to really sink in, have the courage to be vulnerable, to open up, to risk being hurt, or to be able to navigate the complexities of a true attachment love, which is about autonomy and connection, which can be a challenge for a lot of people to understand that dance between being an autonomous individual and a connected pair, our capacity for all of that is really determined by what we saw growing up and how that was normalized or not normalized in our religious group or in our community or in our culture. And so there, that variable really makes it difficult for us to say, here is one thing you can do, or here are the tools you can use, and you will have a long-term successful relationship. And I guess that's what makes life messy and fun all at the same time.
Right.
Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for calling and have a wonderful week.
You too.
So, Tyler, I think I want to take the time here at the end of the show to talk about if you are diving in, if you have that capacity, and I want to also finish with Ken, if you haven't had that training or that modeling or that opportunity to develop those attachments, or you've had your heart crushed, or your parents were divorced and you never want to allow yourself that pain, or if you suffered the loss of a dear loved one and you never want to go to that place, our ability to love and the capacity to move towards attachment can be awakened. It can be nurtured back to whole with patience and with time. It's not something that we can just wish for. We can't just say, I want it to be better. I wish I had better relationship. It is a process of unlearning and relearning different ways to engage. Some people say that my radar is broken or my picker is broken. I always choose the wrong person. I always get my heart broken. And that awareness is a good start. But in order to change our radar or our picker, we have to do the internal work to kind of find out at what point in our life did we lose the capacity to kind of trust our instincts or to know what we were looking for. And I want to finish up by going back to John Gottman's work. And he, as I said, he looks at relationships kind of through the potential for divorce in a marriage. But he looks at that from the ways that we can actually prevent our relationships from going sour. And he talks about kind of these secrets to long-lasting love. And I want to go over just a few of the main ones. The first one is attitude. That our attitude we have about love and our relationship is key. Every morning you wake up and you get to choose how you feel about this relationship. You know, I'm in it. I love this person. This is where I want to be. And it's this mantra. We talk about doing meditation for our health and having good mantras and thinking positively about our work and thinking positive about this next promotion we want. But we don't talk about thinking positively or doing a mantra around our relationship, but it's equally as important because our attitude about the relationships we're in drives how we feel about that partnership. The next one is generosity, to be generous with ourselves and our time and our expressiveness with our partners, to not hold back. A lot of times when we fear being hurt, we tend to not want to give too much so that we can prevent ourselves from being hurt. But then in our efforts to not get hurt, we don't give out enough. And so people leave us because they never get to experience that full love that you have. You know, that when you hold back for fear of getting hurt, you lose the relationship because the person never feels your love. And so this aspect of being generous and being open and feeling that I have an endless capacity of ability to give, that if I give all of my love to you and you take it and run, it doesn't mean I am then zapped of ever having love again. We actually multiply it the more we trust and give it out. The next piece he talks about is kindness. And kindness seems, you know, like this silly throwaway thing. It's like, of course we should always be kind. But he said that kindness is actually the heart of whether or not our relationships thrive. Because people want to feel safe and comfortable in their relationships. And it's not that some people are kind and some people are not. Kindness is not a fixed attitude. Actually, kindness is it's a muscle. It's a habit we develop that we have to nurture, that needs to be formed, that we have to feel again our attitude and feel motivated by this kindness to another.
Sometimes you like somebody so much that you start being mean instead of being kind, and you don't think about because it still comes from love, but it's
right. It's
different.
Like that poking
at it. You have to work harder.
Yes, and because again, the more we feel in love with someone, the more risk we're taking, and so then we're more apt to be mean or push them away because we're unconsciously trying to protect our heart. And then here's the last piece that I want to leave you with today, is that in our relationships, we're all craving connection. We're all looking for moments of connection. And quite often we miss those moments that we could really make a difference in the attachment we feel in our relationship. So for example, Let's say you're with your, you know, I'm with my husband and he's looking out in the backyard and he says, hey, look, there's a goldfinch out in the I can't even think it's called the bird feeder. There's a goldfinch at the bird feeder. Come check it out. And if my first response is, what a stupid goldfinch. Why do you like them so much? And I just get annoyed. I've missed a huge opportunity because in that moment that my husband's saying, come check out the goldfinch in our backyard, it's not really about the finch. It's about him asking for connection, asking for me to come towards him, a moment of being together. And so in that moment, I have two choices. I either turn towards him and say, oh, I love that you saw that bird. I love that you care so much about this. Or I love that it's something that you wanted to share with me. Or I choose to turn away. And if I turn away and dismiss it and say, I don't care about you, stupid bird, it's not about the bird. What I'm saying to him is, I don't care about us. I don't care about this moment of connection. And so John Gottman said, the beginning and end of marriages are all about those moments when we had a chance to either turn towards our loved one, when they're asking for connection, and they're never going to ask in an obvious way. Maybe they'll say, give me a hug or come sit with me. But those real asks for connection are more subtle. You know, hey, I'm making this new meal. You want to come in and help me in the kitchen? You can turn towards them and say, sure, I want to do that with you. Or you can turn away and say, yeah, you just finish. Or, hey, I just read this great thing. I want to read you that paragraph. It's not about the paragraph. It's about wanting to be connected in that moment, to feel the heart connection. And so you choose to turn toward or you choose to turn away. And so for Valentine's Day, I encourage you to turn towards, to pay attention to the small things, to trust that you have a capacity to go deeper than you ever thought you could with love. And even though that chance also comes with a capacity of great grieving, that great grieving is always a sign that you also felt love that others will never, ever know. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT. You can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or podcast. I would like to say thank you to Tyler for being my producer these last few years. Today's our last show together, and you're setting off into the wild blue yonder, and I'm going to miss you, my friend.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. It's been really great working with you. And what a great show to end on about love.
I've loved lurking with you. Happy Valentine's Day. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
that you're not.